Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from A to Z Wineworks, offering cool climate wines that capture the essence of Oregon since 2002. This episode features an hour with Elizabeth Gilbert and Ann Patchett in conversation as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 2009. Gilbert is a novelist, short story writer, and memoirist who became famous with her fourth book, Eat, Pray, Love, which was an international bestseller. And Ann Patchett, too, became famous for her fourth book, a novel entitled Bel Canto. Both writers have enjoyed success ever since with numerous best-selling works. What's not widely known about these two writers is that they became close friends through letter writing, not emails, actual letters through the mail. In fact, this onstage conversation was only the second time they'd ever met in their long relationship. What is special about this episode is that, though Gilbert and Patchett have an audience of over 2,000 people watching, their conversation feels completely unguarded. We get to listen to how these two world-class writers talk to each other about their lives and their writing, and as the conversation gradually unfolds, we get closer and closer to really understanding who these writers are and what makes them tick. Here's Patchett and Gilbert.
So, my friend Anne, this is the second time we have ever met face-to-face.
Are we counting yesterday?
Yes, including yesterday. The second segment of time
in which we have ever met.
The second event. And Anne's going to tell you about how we met.
We met at a panel for the American Library Association, and there were six of us. There were six women writers, and we all got up to give a little talk.
In a ballroom,
and there was a chicken dinner. Do you remember that? It was like a wedding dinner. Chicken. It was the most enormous chicken, and we all had dinner beforehand. but we got up on stage and we just did our thing. But we really liked each other, and there was no time.
There was zero time.
And people were coming at us in this giant wave, and we exchanged addresses and not email and not phone numbers. And then we went home and started writing letters. And I remember I gave you a galley for run, and you left it in a hotel room. And the maid, you called the maid, and she was saying it was Ron?
Yeah, she said, I found your book called Ron.
Ron.
I thought was very sweet. What I think is interesting, and we have never talked about this, is I don't know how we decided that this was going to be a letter-writing friendship and not a telephoning and emailing friendship. And I hope you don't feel that you're not allowed to telephone or email me, because we've emailed a couple times when it's urgent, and it's always very apologetic. Like, I know, I know we're not supposed to do this, but, you know, blah, 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 some little quick thing. And I don't know quite how. I just know that our first letters crossed in the mail, and from then on, you know, and it's one of the most important relationships in my life. And I also have to tell you that every time I get a letter from you, because these are beautiful letters, I mean, 4-page long.
They're really long. They're really
wonderful
good.
Letters. And it's this event in my life, and it's becoming ever rarer that you get words like that intimately on paper. I come home and my husband says to me, darling, you have a letter from your friend Ann Patchett. And he always says, your friend, which I think he's really proud of the fact that Ann Patchett is my friend. And then he always sort of presents it to me. And then I go someplace far away and I sit very quietly with it and I make a little event out of it. And it's the loveliest thing. It's just been very, very wonderful.
It really has been. It is a lovely thing. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you, and this is a strange question, but can it be a real, true, full friendship if we don't see each other?
Well, we're seeing each other now.
But really, we planned this so we could see each other, because we both travel too much, and we both have a really crippling house guest disorder, where we have way too many people coming to visit us.
Or as Anne calls it, at the world's most terrible house guest infestation.
I have actually packed off to hotels because I've had house guests for like 60 nights in a row. Mm. I have an amazing house for house guests, and you can't pry them out with a fork. So because we're really aware of this, we're not probably going to visit one another.
Yeah.
We're not going to take a trip. Well, we could do something like this together.
This is good. And I think we should be mic'd whenever we're actually in person.
I think...
I think that would just take it right up to the next level and make it more epic.
That's a really good idea. Can you, and like in a diner or in the yoga class, we would be mic'd and talking while we were living our life? Because our friendship is so important.
Actually, we're loud enough that it's sort of like we're mic'd. We went to a yoga class today, and I think we might as well have been mic'd when we were there.
Can you imagine going to a yoga class with Liz Gilbert? It was wild. It was wild. I might as well have gone with Mick Jagger.
I think Mick Jagger is limberer.
Well, it's like, you know, if you go to the opera with me, you know, it's my group. And everybody's like, there she is, there she is. It's in the yoga class, it's just like that.
That's very sweet. Okay, so one of the things I want to talk to you about is, and one of the things I wanted to tell everybody is that there are some uncanny similarities between myself and Anne that we have discovered in this letter-writing relationship. That, you know, we're both female writers who take our writing craft extremely seriously. We both worked for a long time and without a lot of reward, and then had huge fourth books, which I think is a curious fact. We both had bad first marriages and then really good second marriages to men who are 16 and a half years older than us.
Yes.
And we're both happily, I dare say, ecstatically childless. We both have relationships with a pet that border on idolatry, that are sort of, so a lot of our letters are about her fat little dog, Rose, and my fat, huge cat, Clifford.
And Clifford could so take Rose.
And we both have this question that I think has been running through a lot of our letters, certainly over the last year, which is, how do you balance, we both have this thing, we have a lot of people in our life that we take care of, and in various ways that we nurture or support or love and need to sort of be around, and which takes up a huge amount of our lives. And I think the sort of fundamental question that runs through these letters is, how are we to be serious writers and also be this kind of person? And as you posed in one of your recent letters, before the great John Updike died, does John Updike ever have to suspend writing projects because he has to change the sheets in the guest room, you know? And
did I tell you my agent had an apron made for me that said, "What would Philip Roth do?" Because that was my. I'm from Nashville, so everybody has those "What would Jesus do?" bracelets, and I'm always saying when my publisher asks me to do something that I find tacky and demeaning, I always say, like, I totally understand that I'm not Philip Roth. But would you ask Philip Roth to do this? What would Philip Roth do? And I say it so often that she got me this great apron.
Which is probably why I asked you in that last letter, would Philip Roth have to walk away from the middle of a book for a weekend because he promised his sister's kids that he would take them to the Renaissance Fair? You know, like, yeah. hard to picture.
But now let me ask you this, because I really do think that not having children, I have this sort of energy credit in my life that goes out to other people. Mm-hmm. And I mean, seriously, it's almost like a debt to the cosmos. Mm-hmm. Because
Because you still didn't lose the 100 weeks of sleep.
That's your first, right. Yeah. I mean, I still do so much less for other human beings than any average woman who has one child of any age.
Yeah.
I still am expending less energy on other people. And so I do sort of feel like it's a debt I owe. It's sort of like if you go out to dinner with a girlfriend who has a kid, you always have to pay because the girlfriend has to pay the babysitter.
And their college education. That's
absolutely
what I always think about.
There should be a tax orthodontia on childless people.
Orthodontia.
No, I think that's really true.
Think about the money we save.
I mean, there's people who say, why do I have to pay for education? I don't have a child. And I'm like, that's exactly why you don't have to pay for it. You should be paying for education. You should like totally just pick a random kid and send them to college because you didn't have to pay for all of their soccer shoes and all that other junk.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
So I do, when I'm manically running around helping people, I really do think it's that unused, untapped part of my existence.
I have a theory about this.
Please.
And I I've been thinking about it a lot lately because of the book that I just finished, which is about marriage. And I have a whole big section in there about childlessness, because I think it's an interesting topic because it involves me.
And therefore,
it's riveting to the world. Just who could tear themselves away from reading about why I'm childless? Who would not want to know? And it's, do you know, here's a little interesting fact, that on, there's an average across history in just about every society of 10% of women never have children anywhere and across time and in history. And an average of 10% of all women across history die in childbirth. And I feel like there's a dovetail there. And I have this theory of this thing I call the anti-brigade that I talk about all the time, that there's an evolutionary need for responsible, loving, compassionate, childless women in every society to step in with unabated energy and care for people who are not their biological responsibility, because that is a task that childless women often take on. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I take on in my life. I adopt all kinds of people and take care of them in all sorts of ways. And I wouldn't know myself if I didn't do that. But I do wonder if those like ambitious male writers, are they running around picking up food for the food bank? Are they doing that?
No.
You know who I'm talking about? Like the big guys? Like, are they?
Was Mailer? You know, in between the fifth and the sixth wife.
In a minivan, picking up baskets of food in his town and bringing them to the food pantry every Friday morning?
No.
I don't think so.
Oh, but then he had a lot of kids.
He had a lot of kids?
Mailer. That could have been he was taking them to Little League or something.
I'm sure he was very hands-on with all his kids.
You know, I this would be such a better story if I could actually remember where I read this quote, but it was in a novel, and a character, a male character, sneeringly says of another man, he wasn't really a man because he'd never killed anyone, and a man couldn't really be a man until he had taken another human life, in the same way a woman could never really be a woman until she had produced another human life. And I just thought, that totally lets me off the hook, because I'm not interested in men who've killed other men. And so therefore, it would make sense to me that I wouldn't want to have children.
I have never had a child.
Get your head around that, yeah?
But I killed a man. So
I shot a man
that
in
should
Reno
make
once.
Up for the fact that I never had a child.
You killed a man?
No, I never killed anybody.
But I remember I said to my husband, who's just phenomenally gullible and has no popular culture references, and we were having this kind of conversation once, and I said, I shot a man in Reno once just to watch him die, and he said,
you what? Just to watch him die?
Got that Johnny Cash
record. So one
Cash
thing that
record.
I find curious about my friend Ann Patchett, and I call her that because my husband calls her that, and she's my friend, is that there's a way that you describe yourself, and we were talking about it today too. When you read Truth and Beauty, there's a line in there where you say that you were talking about your invisibility and the fact that when you were in college, you were always mistaken for other people. And in letters to me, you've said things like, I'm a very small person. You know, I'm a sort of invisible person. I'm a shy person. And then I don't know how to reconcile that with what I consider the mighty fortitude of your presence, you know, on the page and in person. And
I've got a great story. A couple months ago, there was there's a big book conference in Nashville every year, the Southern Literary Festival, which I call the Festival of Ann Patchett Stalkers. I can't stand it. Going to a book fair in your own hometown, No, very bad. But I had to do it this year. It was the first time in years I was doing it. And I was going to see my friend Susan Orlean give a talk. Mm-hmm. And I'm in the elevator. It's in the Capitol building. And this guy's in the elevator. We're all packed in there. And we're trying to figure out where to go. And where are you going? Who are you going to go see? I'm going to go see Susan Orlean. Oh, I'm going to go see Susan. Okay, then it's this way. And I'm walking with this guy who's, you know, in his 60s. And he's talking. He's very chatty. Oh, I just love Susan Orlean. I love The Orchid Thief. He's telling me all of this stuff. And then he says to me, do you ever go to the library, the adult story hour at the library, where they have people read? There was some better, more natural transition, but you get the picture. And I said, oh, yeah, I do. I do go to the adult story hour at our public library sometime. He said, well, were you there when Ann Patchett read? And no, listen, don't save your energy for laughing because the story gets much better. And I thought, he's old, you know, I'm not going to cat and mouse him. I said, actually, you know what, I am Ann Patchett. And he said, I can't believe, I cannot believe that. I was there. I've seen you read in bookstores. I have seen you so many. I cannot, in my wildest, you are so average.
Oh.
In my wildest dreams, I would never believe that you were everything about you. Talking to you in the elevator, looking at you right now. You are so, he said it like 58 times. And then the next time I read at the library, he came and sat in the front and he said, do you want to just get a gun and shoot me? Because I have wanted to kill myself ever since. I have so many stories like that, you know, of being in LaGuardia and they call out my name so I can bring my bag over. And the woman says, there is no way in the world you're the author. And I'm like, yeah, I am. And she's like, my God, I mean, is the fact that you are so unbelievably plain the reason that you can get into other... So I feel like, I don't know, if you give me a mic or something, my little light comes on.
Yeah.
Because I do move through this planet unnoticed.
And I asked her today, one of the questions that I ask everyone, that's my friend John Hodgman's question, which is flight or invisibility, right? You've got
a
choice
your answer?
Of superpowers. Typically, I can't decide. But I think probably I would have to go with flight because I think if you have the opportunity to do that. I always want to trade them both in for the ability to breathe underwater, which I think would be really cool.
It's called scuba diving.
I'm about
we
to trade in
a
superhero power for something you can just do. You can learn to do it the why.
But... So I asked Anne, and she said, "I'm already invisible."
Yeah.
And to you know, to me that sounded sort of sad, except for that it's the way that you described it. It was an asset.
Oh, it's joy.
And then she said that anything she can ever do that would reduce her invisibility, or rather increase her visibility, she decidedly does not do. You know, when the hairdresser says, "Don't you want to go blonde?" You know, no. You know, like the invisibility is of an essence, And then you were saying when you became famous that this became a problem because you sort of lost your invisibility, which you felt was a superpower, I may be paraphrasing here, that you needed in order to be an observer, an invisible observer, which got me to thinking about the fact that I have never been a
fucking
invisible.
This is a woman with a beacon of light. You stand in the cone of light. And I've
well,
known,
that's the...
No.
But the...
I actually have known a couple of people like that. I mean, Renee Fleming is like that. No matter when you see her, no matter what circumstances, she stands in a cone of light. She is total radiance, and you're like that. Because even you've just got that going on, it doesn't have anything to do with your career. It doesn't even have anything to do with your beauty. It's just, you've got the light.
But I think it's interesting that we're both writers, and that for me, what I would consider to be the skill that I must never lose, or I will not be able to do my job, is to be able to thrust myself into any situation whatsoever and kind of rally the people in that situation to really like me so that they'll cooperate with what I need out of them. You know, like it's, and that is how I got that book written about lobster fishermen. You know, like I didn't go up to Maine and sort of be invisible. I went up to Maine and just kind of railroaded this little island into taking me in and putting me on their boats and being friends with them and telling me their stories. And you know, it's just a skill that I have that is the opposite of invisibility. And I just think it's interesting that for you, the operative skill is to vanish and watch. But you know, here's the other really big difference between us that I didn't realize until today. Anne makes up just about everything. Anne
well,
is a true novelist.
I was just gonna say.
You know, she's a true novelist. And I'm not, like even my novel, I had to go research the hell, everything I've ever written, I've had to go roll around in to an extreme that's really different from the way that you work.
Okay, and then this leads me to a question. This is a bit of a jump, but one of the things that really strikes me about Liz, and I want to say this for any of you who have not had this experience, your fourth book was huge, huge, you know, a worldwide phenomenon, but you had three amazing books before that book that were so incredibly different. My fourth book was a much smaller phenomenon, but, you know, a totally different in terms of sales big thing. But really, my first three books were novels. They, you know, you read one, you read that one. It's not like one is particularly better than the other one or so different, or you're going to learn. This is not discouraging you from running out and buying my backlist. Really, you should. But your backlist is a revelation. And I really do think that there are a lot of people who read Eat, Pray, Love who see it not as a book, but as an experience. Mm-hmm. And that you had this amazing experience, not that you are an amazing writer, because they read it in that way, from like their emotional center of this was my divorce, or this is what I want to do, or I want to go to Italy and reinvent myself. It is such an intensely personal experience. And I think that a lot of people feel like, well, I wonder why I didn't think of doing that. Mm. But what they need to do is go back and read those first three books to see the phenomenal level of skill that you have as a writer.
All of which are available in paperback and make excellent gifts for any
occasion. You can't believe. But I'm trying to think, there are so few people who have a collection of short stories. I'm a huge short story advocate, but there are not a lot of really, truly great short story collections. Pilgrims is a phenomenal collection.
Thank you, sweetheart.
And that book about, that the story about Bonnie the Bunny, I can't stop thinking about it. We should talk about that later in the bar. And then you've got a novel. So you've got a collection of short stories. You've got a novel. You've got a book of reporting, a book of journalism, The Last American Man, which is off the charts, the book that I give to everyone I know. And then you've got Eat, Pray, Love. And I really got to know you. We both freelanced for GQ with the same editor. We never met. And then that editor moved to the New York Times Magazine, and we both freelanced for the New York Times Magazine. I can remember the stories about you bartending. I can remember the stories about the sex doll. That was the best. Does anybody know this?
I went to a factory in California where they make phenomenally expensive, anatomically correct sex dolls. And it was interesting.
Talk about a piece.
It was a family, it was a cottage industry. It was a family who made them.
It was before you passed things around on the internet. Everybody I knew had a copy of that story. I mean, it was a phenomenal piece of reporting. But how many people are there who can do a book of short stories, who can do a novel, who can do reporting, who can do a memoir? And what my question is, in case you were wondering if I actually have one, if you close your eyes and you see yourself and you say, this is my true thing, do you have that?
Do you mean out of those genres?
Yes. Just in general, what's your true thing? Anything.
Well, if I close my eyes and I think of, you know, which book I am the most proud of, it's Pilgrims. It's the short story collections. I think it's the best writing I've ever done. And I don't think I will ever write like that again. Because those stories, no one ever wanted them as I was writing them. So there was no attachment to them whatsoever about, they were written in such a vacuum of isolation.
How old were you when you published that book?
I was 26, but there's stories in that book there's a story in that book that I wrote when I was 19. You know, like, these were stories I was writing when I was in college, and that I was, you know, these, and each one took me about as long to write as it now takes me to write a book. In fact, some of them took longer than it now takes me to write a book.
Well, that would mean that you would have had to have started when you were 12. I mean, the numbers.
Well, there
don't
aren't
crunch.
That. No. Well, there's only 10 stories in there, so they and I can. I can write a book pretty fast now. You know, but I was learning how to write. You know, and every word was so selected. You know, and every sentence was so selected. And I literally could not do that again. Because, and I wouldn't want to either, because I'm what I'm all about now and what I want more than anything is for the writing to be as conversational as it can possibly be. I want it to be as unartful as it can possibly be. I am so lately obsessed with the idea of just telling the story and getting as much out of the way and letting, you know, making it, I want it to go down as easy as it can. And so I will never write these faceted, polished things again. But I love them, and I love them also for how much I love the person who was writing them without any chance of reward, you know, and just from a great sense of love and loyalty to, and writing them when I was like bartending, and writing them when I was waitressing, yeah. and writing them when I was getting my heart broken again and again in my 20s, and all this sort of stuff that was going on.
Have you read them again?
I actually am a little bit afraid to, because I remember them as being better than they probably are. But I, because I'm
really
so proud of them.
Yeah.
But I don't think of myself, when I shut my eyes, I don't think of myself as a fiction writer, I don't think of myself as a short story writer. I don't see the big, giant difference between all those different kinds of writing, to be honest, because it's not like I'm a writer and I'm a dentist. You know, it's not like I'm a fiction writer and I'm a dentist. I'm a writer who, I had a business card made for myself once, a friend of mine who was a designer, and he said, what do you want the title to be? And I said, can you just do like a delivery van, and on the side of the van it says Words Are Us, and like 24-hour service. Whatever needs wording, I can word, you know? Like that's kind of how I feel about, maybe not a play. I don't think I would know how to write a play. But I don't see that as a really, I've always been a little bit surprised by the distinction, because, and you should know, because you've written nonfiction and you've written
fiction.
Yeah,
there's a big difference for me.
Which is?
I mean, I write a lot of nonfiction, and I love writing essays. Oh my gosh, I just adore writing essays. But writing fiction is so hard for me.
It's hard for me too.
And
that's why you haven't seen me do it in a decade.
Is just writing nonfiction is a snap.
Yeah.
It's not that I think it's easier for me.
Yeah.
It's easier.
Yeah.
And sometimes I wonder if I stopped writing fiction, if nonfiction would then become difficult. Mm-hmm. But if I'm writing a novel and somebody calls and says, I need a 2,000-word essay, I need a 5,000-word essay by tomorrow, I'm like, oh, okay, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
I can pull it out of the air because it's not fiction. And fiction is just grindingly difficult and slow.
300-page hair shirt is what a friend of mine calls it. the act of trying to write a novel. And that's why I've written one, you know? Because it is phenomenal. You have to invent a world. You have to, and when you're writing nonfiction, you just have to report a world, or you have to sort of bring a world to somebody that's already in existence, which I think is a lot easier. I think, and we were talking about this today. I keep feeling like I sort of should write fiction again, you know, to be taken seriously, blah 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 blah. But I do think that you have to write the thing that causes a revolution in your mind when you have the idea, that makes your heart race and makes the hair go up on the back of your neck, that you can't not write. And lately for me, that just hasn't been. I have ideas for novels, but they just feel like so diligent. Like I diligently think that I could write a novel about this, but it just seems like so unthrilling. And so I have to do other things for now.
Well, especially when there are 5 million people who would really like to read another book of nonfiction, you know, you might as well write another book of nonfiction. But do you ever think that there will come a time in your life that you won't write?
At all. I'm absolutely open to that possibility that there, and in fact, I really explored that last summer because I finished a book that I had been working on, and I had an experience that I have never had in my writing life. I did what I always do. I worked ferociously on this book and put everything into it that I had, and I finished it, and it was a 500-page long manuscript, and I went to Kinko's and I got it copied, and I opened it up to the middle when you get the copy and you're like, oh look, it's paged, you know, and I opened it up to the middle and I read a sentence and I shut it and I said, this is awful. And that's not what I normally feel or do, you know, and I just, all of a sudden I realized this is just awful, and it's wrong, everything about it is wrong. No one has read a word of that book. And I, as I told you in my letters, I went home and I had a bit of a crisis because it was due, and it was anticipated eagerly, and I had been paid for it, and all these sorts of things, and I just wrote a letter to my editor, and I said, I can't give you this book. It's not that I'm lazy. I did it. It's just I don't know what's wrong with it. And I remember once interviewing Tom Waits about the creative process, and he said that he and his wife, his writing partner, when a song just isn't working, they have a code expression, and the expression is, "Our flamingo is sick." And isn't that the most wonderful thing? Because what do you do with a sick, like, how do you even diagnose what's wrong with it? Like, it's a little droopy.
Like,
it's a
little, like some sort of throat problem.
What do you
usually
give it, like aspirin? Like, how do you fix a sick flamingo? And it's just sick. It's just not flamingoing. And so I just said, I don't know what's wrong with this. And I don't know that I will ever want to rewrite it. I don't know what I'm going to do. And you can have your money back if you would like it, tomorrow, of course. But please don't make me give you this book. And I can't even promise that a year from now you'll have another. I really just, this has never happened to me before. There's no model or template for this. I would like to please remain a Viking Penguin author on an indefinite sabbatical, you know? And I said, I can't see that I won't ever write another book, but I might not. I don't know. This has never happened. And I put it in a box under my bed, and I took 6 months off, and I learned how to garden, and I planted tomatoes, and I rode my bicycle constantly, and I swam in the Delaware River, and we had a lot of picnics, and it was a beautiful summer. And when the weather turned, my mind started to realize how I could fix that book, and I sat down and rewrote it, and now I'm very happy with it. But during that six-month period, I gave serious contemplation to the fact that perhaps I was done, you know, that maybe the whole point of all the love and effort and devotion that I have put into this life of writing was to culminate in writing Eat, Pray, Love. That all the books that came before it were to learn how to write, and all the discipline that came before it was to learn how to meditate, and all of that stuff was so that I could do this book that apparently a lot of people really care about, and that was my reason to be here, and now I can maybe do something else. And I wasn't quite sure what that other thing was, but it didn't feel horrible to feel that. In fact, it was a nice little piece of permission to just feel like, and if that is the case, then we will just figure out what the rest of the life will be. And I was really okay with that, except for that come September, the little thing started to crank, like the little coffee grinder started to say, well, you know, if you took out that chapter and moved it over here, and if you changed the beginning to this, and if you made it less about this and more, and the little architect, you know, and then by October, I couldn't wait to get my hands in it again. And then I had a great time rewriting it. So the answer is, yeah, I can see it happening. And I would be willing to let it happen unless I wanted to write more than I didn't want to. And you?
Well, you know, thank you for the long, patient listening to that.
One thing that people ask me a lot, people ask about the muse and what do you do when you have writer's block? Mm-hmm. People always want to know, how do you get over writer's block? And I always say, I don't believe in writer's block. I mean, I really believe that there's a time to write and a time not to write. And there may be really long stretches of time not to write, because you can't put a piece of corn in the ground one day and eat the ear of corn the next day. I mean, things have to grow. Ideas have to grow in you without putting anything down on paper for a long time. And so it makes perfect sense to me that a period of time when something actually is growing and you're learning, but maybe at a level so deep that you can't even see it or understand it. And then it flowers at the moment that it's supposed to. I try not to be crazy name dropping, although my life is so intermeshed with Renee Fleming's life that it's impossible for me not to drop her name about certain things. But
can you imagine being Renee Fleming's best friend? Consider
I'm Renee
what
Fleming's,
that would be like.
I always say, I'm the little goat that they keep in the thoroughbred stall to keep the thoroughbred calm. But it's so amazing to me that she can go for 10 years without singing a role. She's in Baden-Baden right now singing Der Rosenkavalier. She hasn't sung Der Rosenkavalier in like 12 years. She hasn't looked at it. And not only does she know it all, she knows it more deeply because it goes into this composting place with her. And she's always saying that language is like that. She's fluent in everything. And you know, she'll go for years without speaking German, and then she goes back to Germany, and her German is better than it was the last time she was in Germany.
I have not had this experience with Italian.
Just says, it's like,
I'm just going to ignore my Italian and let it improve. It's not how it...
The idea that it's in there somewhere, percolating away in ways that we don't understand, I really find that unbelievably comforting. I was telling Liz today at lunch about an idea for a novel that I had that I just didn't want to write. And I didn't have another idea for a novel. I love it when people come up to me and say, do you have like 15 unbelievable ideas for novels and you just can't even begin to know which one to pick next? And I'm
yes.
like, if I have one lousy idea every 3 or 4 years, it is such a mitzvah. But I only had this one idea and I just didn't want to write the book. I didn't want to write the book so badly. And then I finally had another idea that freed me, and it was an idea I really wanted to write. But the idea that I could come back to that novel that I didn't want to write, and I mean, this is all in my head, not a word of it exists on paper, and I've told like 2 people about it because it seemed so bad it was embarrassing.
She told me the idea, it's a really good idea.
5 years from now, it could come back around and really be formed.
Yeah. Or you can cut it up for scrap, or you can cut it up for bait and use it to catch other novels.
I don't believe that.
I have had that experience.
My ideas are totally non-transferable.
It's got to be that thing.
And I know a lot of people...
They're organs, in other words. Yeah, they have to just be... Yeah.
People who cut out a scene from a novel and save it and work it into another...
Does the other manuscript reject it like it's a kidney from a bad donor? It just doesn't work?
It's all the metaphors I can think of to describe that are disgusting. You know what? It's just, it's belongs to that other thing for me.
And yeah.
It doesn't move.
Do you know who Clive James is, the critic, the Australian English critic Clive James? He, in one of his memoirs, he's an avid memoirist, which is a trait I admire. And he wrote in one of his memoirs about this big catastrophe disaster that he had in his life once when he wrote, produced, directed, and took all of his family's money and invested in a play on the West End that bombed so spectacularly that his name, and you know the British press is really gentle with people when they don't do well.
Oh,
and he was just drawn and quartered and tarred and feathered. And he not only failed, but he humiliated a lot of his friends who he involved in it because they failed and they were humiliated by being involved in it. It was just as, and he bankrupted his family. And he went home and sat in a chair for several months and did nothing for months and months and months while his wife sort of worked to hold the family together into this big depression. And then his little daughter got a used bicycle, and she didn't like the color, and so one day he got up off the chair and he painted the bicycle blue, and then he got little paint and he put like hundreds of little tiny stars all over the bicycle so that it looked like a sorcerer's cape. And this took him a couple days, right? I mean, because we were really intricate. And when he was done, she rode off, and then the next day a little girl came and knocked on the door and asked him if he could do the same thing to her bicycle. And so he sat in the yard and he painted her bicycle blue and he drew hundreds of little tiny stars on it. And then one by one, every single child in this neighborhood for an entire summer came, and he spent the entire summer painting fields of constellations on little kids' bicycles. And when the last bicycle was done, he said, it's time for me to get back to work
writing. Oh my
God.
I get that so profoundly. And that's such a beautiful, happy story
to me. Isn't that wonderful?
That makes infinite sense. Can I just tell you what I would do if I wasn't a novelist, what I would do for a living?
What?
I would make dioramas.
Like Joseph Cornell?
Yeah. Well, no, probably not that artful. But... But you know, in Widener Library at Harvard, those huge dioramas as you go in, I just
want to make... Oh, you mean dioramas with like animals?
Yeah.
Little like trees. Like taxidermy?
No, tiny. I mean, everything miniature, but not doll. I don't like dollhouse stuff, but just...
Landscapes?
Yeah, landscapes, scenes, you know, villages, the
Have
pilgrims.
Have you ever made a diorama, or
no.
you just feel like you would be good
no,
at that?
I would be really good at that. Like painting the little stars. I mean, it's this tiny, the building of the tiny world, which is really just writing a novel, is what's so appealing to me. So what would you do?
Ladies and gentlemen, dioramist Anne Patchett. I would work in a fine clothing boutique. As I told you today when we went to a fine clothing boutique.
I thought you were joking.
I
would
was
you really?
Totally
I mean, like, if you could
not
do
joking.
Anything, you would do that? You would?
I'm really frighteningly, alarmingly good at sales. And
Don't you know that's the truth?
I have a thing. I got it from my grandfather. My grandfather's the greatest salesman I've ever known, and my parents have a Christmas tree farm, and he came and worked there 1 year, and he made it a sort of point of pride to unload all the bad trees to prove that he could sell anything. And he sold a tree to somebody that had half of, it just had a hole in it about this big that went through. And he said, we save these for the really elite people with giant presents so that they can put them in the trees. I have this running through my veins. I will sell, I used to help my husband sell jewelry at a flea market, and somebody would, he said, I've never seen a person who looked more like a barracuda. When I saw a woman come walking, I would look at her and I would be like, she will buy a piece of jewelry from me, you know? And I could not let, so I think that I would do really well selling, and I like pretty clothes, so I think I would do well selling clothes. I would also like to be a singer-songwriter.
Come to Nashville, but
I can't sing or write songs.
I can hook you up with people you wouldn't believe.
I like the idea of being the folky girl guitar thing, but unfortunately, I have no gift for that. Because I am monodynamic, which is a word I learned recently, which means single talented.
I always say I'm a one-trick pony. I think it makes life easier.
Definitely.
The other thing that I would be really good at, film editing. I mean, everything that I could think of that I would like to do involves being alone in a small dark room.
I think that the reason that most people write, and certainly the reason that I write, is a deep desire to be understood, which in fact makes writing a really tragic joke, because nothing makes you feel quite as misunderstood by as many people as writing a book. Because if you wrote a book about elephants, somebody would come up to you and say, that book about canaries, it was so fantastic. What was the person who, about the, you'd written the book about the dwarf? What was that?
That was the case of somebody not having read my book.
But was it a review or something in a paper?
It was a photographer whose name we shall not mention on the stage, who was taking a picture of me.
Yes.
And had done an interview in a paper, and a picture of me was out on her table, and she said, oh, that's Elizabeth the Kraken. She just wrote this. This only makes sense if you've read The Giant's House, which is about a librarian who falls in love with the world's tallest boy. Becomes the world's tallest man. And she said, oh, she just wrote a fabulous book about a dwarf who falls in love with a librarian.
So much for being profoundly understood. But I do believe that Elizabeth is the person who most understands my work. Not that it's rocket science, but whatever I'm doing, I know that she's behind me. I know that she gets it. So if she says that something is muddled or unclear, I know if it's unclear to her, it has got to be unclear to everyone else, because she is going to read it twice as hard or 25 times as hard, give me every benefit of the doubt, and if she thinks it's muddled, I take it out immediately. In the same way, Elizabeth is the person who is most disposed to like my work, and so if there's something that she doesn't like, it automatically comes out. It seems like the only sensible thing to do. And at the risk of turning this evening's event into a maudlin love fest, my friendship with Elizabeth is really the single most valuable thing that has come out of my writing life. And you know, you can have an editor and a publisher, you can go to graduate school, you can meet a lot of people, you can have a lot of readers, you can publish books, but if you can find one person in your life who understands what you're doing and you feel a sense of connection because they know what you're doing, then somehow life becomes more complete. And when people say to me, should I go and get an MFA? Do you think it's a good idea? I always say, you know, you may not necessarily learn anything, but you have a much better chance if you go to a colony, if you go to an MFA program, if you go to a summer program where there are other writers, of meeting that person who can be a reader for you. And everybody is different. Everyone operates differently. What works for one person isn't going to work for another. I certainly know people who will send out every chapter they read to 15 of their closest friends, and I think, what in the world would I do with 15 opinions on a chapter? I would drown in that much information. But Elizabeth knows how to give me the information that I need when I need it. And I think that that's part of it too. It's having a friend who really knows you, so that if I send her something when I'm fairly early on in the piece, She gives me a lot of encouragement and some general direction. The closer I get to the end, the more I want really concrete details. And by the time I'm finished, I don't need anybody to say anything nice. I want somebody to rip it to shreds and give me a sentence-to-sentence breakdown of what's wrong, because at that point, all I want is everything to be polished and perfect. And I've had editors tell me that my books are... they have less work to do on my books than anything else that they get. And it's not because my books are better in how they're written, but because I have my own private editor who gets everything polished before I send it in. We have something that we started in Provincetown, which was easier when we lived 40 paces apart, called the Insti Edit Service. And what the Insti Edit Service means is that if one of us writes something and we put it in the FedEx envelope and it arrives, the person who opens the envelope, no matter what they're doing, if they're finishing their own chapter, throwing a dinner party, getting married, doesn't matter. You drop down on your knees right in front of the FedEx man at your front door. You rip the envelope open and you read it absolutely right at that moment. Because that's what writers really want more than anything else. I wrote seriously, I never did anything else. We were just talking about this the other day, that this whole notion of do you have any other skills, and I feel like I really never did have any other skills, and so I always went back to writing. And I taught off and on, and I remember when I was 23 and had just finished up at Iowa, I interviewed for a job at the University of Missouri, and I desperately wanted it because I was so broke and I had no idea what I was going to do. And I thought they were going to offer me the job, and one of the guys on the hiring committee said to me, if they offer you this job, you should turn it down. You shouldn't have the security of a job. You should keep yourself out there on the edge. And then they didn't offer me the job, so I didn't have to make that tough decision. But it's always been a weird kind of piecemeal for me. I do a lot of magazine work. I teach every now and then. It's kind of one thing and another. What about you? Well, you had a job.
I'm a librarian.
You had a job, that's right.
I worked at libraries all through high school and college. Then I went to grad school in fiction writing, and then I went to the Fine Arts Work Center, and then I went to library science school and got my M.S. in library science.
This is a woman with three master's degrees.
And worked full-time and then part-time as a librarian and really loved it. Still love it, still regret. Somebody else had asked me to talk about being a librarian, which I won't do much just because if I get started and I'll say, and I love the little catalog cards and I like computer cards and I like reference questions. And
Even when Elizabeth, the Giant's House was out and it had done really well, you went back two days a week or something like that and worked. And I was appalled. Why would you go out of the house and work if you didn't absolutely have to have the money? And you liked it.
I loved it. I loved it. People, you know, people would ask me questions that I could answer. And that does not happen when you're working on a novel.
It does, too, because I call you every 15 minutes and ask you what the annual rainfall in Bolivia is or something.
And
she knows.
I don't know it. I know where it's located.
Do you have another question?
What are you each working on now?
Why don't you go first?
Book. About yay thick.
She's very forthcoming.
12-point Times New Roman. I'm finishing, hopefully, a book about a comedy team.
You're finished with it.
I'm revising. Somewhat modeled on Abbott and Costello. Vaudeville success that then goes into movies to Straight Man and Comic.
It's fantastic. It's really, really good.
Oh, go on.
No, it is. And I'm writing a book that I'll be writing for the rest of my life, and when I finish it, I will print out a copy, take it to Kinko's, make up copies for members of my immediate family, and that will be that. The extent to which this book is going to bomb will be legendary.
It's a great book.
Yeah,
it's
so a book,
wonderful.
Listen to this, friends. It's a book about terrorism and opera in South America. Doesn't that make you want to run right out and get a copy for yourself? And, you know, people say, oh, aren't you worried if you tell big groups of people what you're working on, you're not finished, that somebody might steal your idea? I'm like, No. When I told my editor, he patted my hand. We were in a diner in New York. He's a wonderful old school guy, Cork Smith. He's retired. He used to be the editor-in-chief of Doubleday, and he freelances. He was the editor for Gravity's Rainbow, which makes him either the best or the worst editor in the world. And I told him about this book I was working on, and he said, "Oh, honey, you might want to keep this one under your hat."
It's so good.
Yeah. I mean, but you know, the thing is, if I went into a bookstore and there was a book about terrorism and opera in South America, I wouldn't buy it. It's like the triple kiss of death. So anyway, that's what I'm doing. I'm feeling really good about it.
It's great. It's a literary page journal. I love it.
I think I'm out. Do you have anything else?
No.
Thank you very much. You've been a great audience. We've had a lovely time.
Thank you.
That was Elizabeth Gilbert and Ann Patchett in conversation as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 2009. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. Support for the Archive Project comes from A to Z Wineworks. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts Board, staff, and community. The show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.